Okay, Ezekiel chapter 37.
The hand of Yahweh was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of Yahweh and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Yahweh God, thou knowest. Again he said unto me, prophesy upon these bones and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh God, unto these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and ye shall live. And I will lay sinews upon you, and will bring up flesh upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath in you, and ye shall live. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a shaking. And the bones came together, bone to his bone. And when I beheld, lo, the sinews and the flesh came upon them, and the skin covered them above, but there was no breath. Then he said unto me, prophesy unto the wind, prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, thus saith Yahweh God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they lived, and stood up upon their feet, an exceeding great army. Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, and our hope is lost. We are cut off for our parts. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh, when I have opened your graves for my people and brought you up out of your graves, and shall put spirit in you, and ye shall live, and I shall place you in your own land. Then ye shall know that I, Yahweh, have spoken it and performed it, saith Yahweh.
You know, if I was doing a commentary on Ezekiel 37, because it's so close to the obvious end time prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39, right? And they're obvious because they converge with Revelation chapter 20, and we know how to interpret that. And we'll speak about that when we get there. Well, if I was doing a commentary on Ezekiel right now, I would correlate this breath with the spirit of truth of John chapters 14, 15, and 16. And hope that it indicates some sort of awakening among our people as to what's going on, as to what our political leaders have done to us. That there are probably more true white Christians, even though very few white people are actually Christian, there are probably more white Christians in the world today than there were at any period during the Middle Ages, because none of those Catholics were truly Christians. And I mean, they were on a local level, but not on any sort of national level. No, they weren't. It's, wow. It's difficult to gauge, but I would say this Valley of Dry Bones, I pray it's in our future, or it's a process that we're seeing happen right now, as more and more people become disaffected with the political system and especially the scientific and medical establishments and things like that. I mean, I can't see the future reading the prophecy, but I hope that this Valley of Dry Bones is describing a process that's ongoing as we speak, right? As this era unfolds.
Because I know.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Bill.
Ezekiel 38 and 39 are definitely happening now, and they've been happening for the last 50 to 100 years. Maybe not 100, maybe 70.
Well, in verse 10, the whole house of Israel is raised as an exceeding great army. So it's almost, I never noticed that before. You know, I've read Ezekiel before, obviously, but I never noticed that they were raised as an exceeding great army. So it's almost like our time now, maybe we're spiritually dead, and then the later rains come and like the Spirit of Yahweh comes upon us and we're made alive again, but we're raised up as an exceeding great army. That's sort of like makes me think of Revelation and the marriage supper of the Lamb. Like when we're raised up, we're this army,
right,
that destroys the enemy. Would you?
Right, I agree. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and to be honest, I sort of think of Obadiah too. Like, the house of Israel shall become a flame. So we're raised up, and then we destroy Edom. Like Edom is burned away.
And the Arise and Thresh prophecy in Micah, of course. Right. The come out of her my people army in Revelation chapter 18, 19. I would correlate this prophecy to those.
I just never noticed it was raised as an army before. That's interesting. Any other comments on this?
Yeah, it might be 5 years before I could do a prophecy, a commentary on a prophecy of Ezekiel. It might be 10. I may never do it. It might be over. We might be living in 15-minute cities and not have computers.
Yeah, because this is a long prophet. He is a major prophet. So,
well, I would correlate this to those prophecies in Ezekiel 37. Revelation 18.
Yeah, like the marriage supper of the Lamb, where
chapter 4.
There's a great war. The camp of the saints surrounded, and then the Spirit of Yahweh comes upon them, and a fire comes down from heaven, and all the enemies are destroyed.
That's why I see that breath is the Spirit of Truth. If you don't have the truth, you may as well be one of the walking dead. If you don't have the truth, you're basically lost and constantly playing into the hands of the enemy, and that's most people today. They're constantly playing into the hands of the Jews. They go along with everything they see on television because they don't have that Spirit of Truth that Christ spoke about in John chapters 14, 15, and 16. So at some point, people become disaffected and they repent and that they start to yearn for that Spirit of Truth. And if they stay on that path, they acquire it.
All right. Should I read 15?
Be my guest.
The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel and his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, and join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by these? Say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, Behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel his fellows, and will put them with him, even the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand. And the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thine hand before their eyes. And say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will save them out of all their dwelling places, wherein they have sinned, and will cleanse them. So they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And David my servant shall be king over them, and they all shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments, and observe my statutes, and do them. and they shall dwell in the land that I have given unto Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt. And they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children forevermore. And my servant David shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yeah, I will be their God and they shall be my people. And the heathen shall know that I, Yahweh, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore.
Now that word heathen is actually nations, and it could very well be describing the nations promised to Abraham, which are the nations of Israel. It doesn't mean the other races.
Yeah, usually I do say nations when I see that word heathen, but for some reason I just said heathen then.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I mean, that's what the text says, but it really means nations. And since Abraham was promised to become many nations, those nations very well could be the nations of Israel because they are the world of the scriptures. It's hard to explain that to the couple of new guys that are here, so they'll have to hang out, but I certainly can explain that. It's just not very brief.
Well, in 25 and 26, it says their children's children forever, and then it says everlasting covenant. So who's the covenant with? Their children's children. So
right. The covenant's a racial covenant. It's not a it's not a covenant that anybody can join. It's a racial covenant made very specifically just to one race of people, and that was it.
They shall be my people, not
David, my servant, as he is elsewhere, is simply a type for Christ himself.
Yeah, he will be king over them. So he's not the king of all people. He's the king of these people who will observe his judgments and do his statutes according to this covenant.
Yes. That type is found only here in Ezekiel. I really think it's found in maybe not in those same words. I have to go look. I'm pretty sure it's found elsewhere. It's found in Jeremiah chapter 33. It's found in Hosea chapter 3. So it's found in a couple of other places. This is the only place it's found with that exact phrase is here in Jeremiah 33. But they're both references to Christ, not to the literal King David. Because David was a model for Christ. So he was used as a type.
And the tabernacle is Christ too, because Christ is the tabernacle of God.
Well, yes, that tabernacle, that's not a new temple. That's not a third temple. It would actually be the fourth temple if it was rebuilt. But no, that tabernacle is simply the body of Christ, as Paul and as Christ himself said, destroyed his temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. And John made a parenthetical remark that he was speaking of the temple of his body because the promise of a Messiah is God inhabiting the body of a man, coming as a man to rule over us and to rule over his creation. So yeah, that's a reference to Christ himself. There's many other places in the New Testament where that becomes evident, such as in the statement that they will call his name Emmanuel, meaning they will say that God is with us.
All right, I'll read 38 then. I don't think there's any other comments.
I don't know if there's anything else that's really necessary that we haven't covered.
It's pretty straightforward.
Okay. We can move
38. On. 38 seems pretty short. It's only 23 verses, so I'm just going to read it all. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith Yahweh God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back, and put hooks in thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared and prepare for thyself, thou, and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. After many days thou shalt be visited in the later years. Thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste. But it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith Yahweh God. It shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest and that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, that dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba and Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away the cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog, Thus saith Yahweh God, In the day when my people of Israel dwelleth safely, shalt thou not know it? And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army. And thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the later days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the nations may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. Thus saith Yahweh God, Art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them? Someone's mic is being activated. And it shall come to pass at the same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith Yahweh God, that my fury shall come in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. And the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith Yahweh God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother, and I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and I will rain upon him and upon his bands, and upon the many people that are with him, an overflowing rain, and great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh.
Okay. This is, wow. We would have to walk through half of the Revelation to really understand this. But this correlates to Revelation chapter 20, where we read in that Satan was locked in a pit for 1,000 years. And then when 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, the same exact language here in Ezekiel 38. There's only three places where that language appears, is in Ezekiel chapter 38, Ezekiel chapter 39, and here. And that's really only two places when you think about it. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. That doesn't really speak of literal fire, but we'll leave it at that. That should be cross-referenced to your passage in Obadiah, Joe, that the house of Joseph would be aflame. Well, by that we should know that this passage in Ezekiel chapter 38, this prophecy correlates with Revelation chapter 20. And like I said, we'd have to walk through half of the Revelation. And of course, I've already done the whole commentary on the Revelation to understand that Gog is not a name from the Old Testament. It's not a recognizable name from the Old Testament. It simply refers to something that is large and overpowering. And there are names in the Old Testament that have that same intonation that are related to that word. So Gog is something that's large and overpowering, but isn't necessarily of the race of Adam. It's even if it is from the lands of the land of Magog. And we don't even know where the land of Magog is, because even though we could identify many of the Japhethite nations from Genesis chapter 10 in archaeology, we can't really identify Magog, except to imagine that he lived somewhere in Asia, that his land was somewhere in Asia. So Magog is ambiguous. But Meshech and Tubal we can identify as dwelling around the Black Sea at the time of Herodotus in 450 BC. Those two tribes were Japhethite tribes dwelling around the Black Sea. And it seems that on the expansion of the Scythians and during the Hellenistic period, that they were pushed north into what we understand today as Central Europe or Eastern Russia, or I'm sorry, Western Russia. And we have cities in Russia today that can be identified with these two tribes in Moscow and Tobolsk. Now, that might sound like a fantastic association, but it actually makes sense historically when you think about the Slavic peoples and their relations to the Japhethite tribes of Genesis chapter 10, and look at where they were located in the 5th century BC and where they ended up 500 and 1,000 years later. So it's not really that fantastic. It actually seems to make sense, that association. When we read the prophecy in the Revelation that speaks about the world empires and the seven beasts with the seven heads with the 10 horns, and those seven heads are actually world empires, and then there's an eighth world empire, and it's of the seven, and that must be this Gog. And of course, there's more substantiation to it than what I could give here, but that must be this Gog that's the eighth world empire. And we can identify the eighth world empire because we know the first seven empires as this central banking system, which is of the Jews and these Ashkenazi Jews that came from the land of Magog in Central Asia. That's where they came from. So all of this can be put together to one extent or another And Revelation chapter 20 informs us that this is what's happening to us right now, these floods of aliens who are from lands that were controlled by these people have been over flooding us for the last 50 to 70 years in the United States, at least ever since at least the Immigration Act of I think it was 1967. So that's 56 years that these people have been flooding into our lands. And they came many of them came from these places. We have Sheba and Dedan, and they were Arabs. That they weren't. They were originally white. The Persians were originally white. Even the Ethiopians and the Libyans were originally white, but they all became bastardized. Ezekiel is giving us terms that help us recognize who is overrunning us. Even if they were white when Ezekiel was writing, well, the Ethiopians were already getting mixed with niggers. But they were white when Ezekiel was writing. And today, even though they originated from whites, they originated from Genesis chapter 10, most of them aren't white anymore. So we can see the Arab hordes and the African hordes in this prophecy, and they're going to overrun the mountains of Israel. And we see them today overrunning North America and Europe and everywhere that they could get into that's a Western, formerly Christian nation. When you put this together with Revelation chapter 20, it's unmistakable what's going on. And that this is actually describing what's happening today in the world to Christendom. That there should be, I mean, there's no doubt about it in my mind.
Well, at verse 17, you see how it says, I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets, in those days. Was that first in Exodus that God said he would bring these nations against Israel?
I think you're talking about the promise, the punishments for disobedience in Deuteronomy, perhaps. These nations aren't really, even though the Exodus, the fact that the children of Israel would go into captivity in the north is in Exodus. No, I'm sorry, it's not in Exodus, it's in the book of Numbers. It first appears in the book of Numbers. And it's also in Deuteronomy.
Well, who were the prophets that were prophesied old time in those days? You know, what's this referring to?
Well, aren't this could refer simply to, well, Moses was a prophet, but it could also refer to Hosea, Isaiah, and Amos, who all prophesied of the captivities. And that was they were at least 140 years before Ezekiel.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Hosea was first. I should mention him first. And Jonah could actually be thrown into the mix because his prophecy in his final chapter is about Assyria and captivity, but it's not very clear until after it happened, right? It's pretty ambiguous until it was actually fulfilled. Jonah was 100 years probably, or maybe a little less than that, before Hosea. And then Hosea was the earliest of four contemporary prophets, Hosea, Isaiah, Amos, and Micah. Amos and Micah. Isaiah started just a little later than Hosea, but he lasted the longest. And then Hosea and Micah were in the middle to the end of Isaiah's period. So, yeah, they would be the prophets of old to Ezekiel. They were all 100 to 140 years before Ezekiel.
Well, I was going to say one more thing. At verse 23, I noticed that it says, Yahweh will sanctify himself after he destroys all these enemy nations. So does that mean that, like, God is sanctified when, or cleansed when all the profane nations are destroyed? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, because that's the only way he can keep his promises. That's the only way he could keep his promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so forth. That's the only way he could keep his promises. So he sanctifies himself on their destruction, yes.
But doesn't, like, the word sanctify mean, like, to cleanse, like, to so, like, to make you holy? To make him holy, wouldn't you have to remove all the defiled?
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. He sanctifies himself by keeping his promises.
And by removing all these enemy nations. Like, they're gone now, so I'm sanctified. I'm holy.
Yeah, well, there's more to it. I mean, keeping his law and things like that, yeah. Where his permissive will has allowed these bastards to even exist. I don't know if there's anything else I could speak of, because I mean, I could go into great detail here and we could be all night. It doesn't bother me.
Whatever you want to do, Bill. I'm just checking the word sanctified in the dictionary.
Well, where the Bible talks about their land and wherein their fathers have dwelt and the mountains of Israel, those things aren't necessarily in Palestine. They're not in Palestine. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8, and I'm going to read that for the sake of the new people here. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Well, if you look at the bounds of the ancient Genesis 10 nation, the children of Israel had no inheritance in it anywhere. They had to take the land of the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were singled out because they were mingled. They mixed with the Rephaim, the Nephilim, the Kenites. They mixed with the other races, so they were singled out for that. But Canaan was cursed as soon as he was born anyway. But when you read 2 Samuel chapter... Oh, chapter 7, verse 10. And Nathan the prophet is speaking to David, and they're standing in Jerusalem. And Nathan tells David, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more." Right there, we learn that the children of Israel are going to have a different place to live in. And that's the place given to the fathers. And it wouldn't be in Jerusalem. It wouldn't be in Palestine. Otherwise, this makes no fucking sense. It can't be in Palestine for this to make sense. Because Nathan's telling David that they're going to be in a different place. And in that different place, they will move no more. So when we see these promises of land to Israel, it can't be talking about Palestine. And the mountains of Israel aren't in Palestine. If we go to Micah chapter 4, and Micah chapter 4, he was one of those prophets that was contemporary with Isaiah, and speaking about the children of Israel that were taken off into Assyrian captivity, because that's what Micah was speaking about. And we read that at some point in the future, speaking of Jacob, speaking of the children of Israel, and he shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off, And then they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation anymore. And it goes on to say that he would drive them out of the land, and I will make her that halted a remnant, meaning those that didn't go far away, those that didn't migrate far away would only be a remnant, and her that was a cast far off a strong nation, and Yahweh shall reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth forever. So that's Micah chapter 4, verse 7. So those of our race who stayed in Central Asia, or who stayed in Anatolia or Mesopotamia, or even Eastern Europe, they became a remnant, because most of those people were overrun by Mongols and Arabs, converted to Islam, and they became a remnant or even a nothing. And those of us who migrated afar off, whose ancestors left Mesopotamia and East Asia and migrated afar off, became stronger nations. We became strong nations the further away we got. So if you take Deuteronomy 32:8, 2 Samuel chapter 7, Micah chapter 4, there's three witnesses right there that the land that Yahweh foresaw the people of Israel inhabiting in the future was not Palestine. It couldn't have been Palestine. There's other prophecies I could bring into that explanation, but I'd have to sit and think about where the hell they are. Like hedging up the way with thorns so that they couldn't return to Jerusalem. And I think that's in Hosea.
And then the Jews, like, they're pretending they're real Israelites because they go back to Israel and, like, a rebuilding.
Right, and that's in Malachi chapter 1. That it would be Esau that rebuilt those places, and that they would be thrown down. So the land that Gog and Magog are invading, and all these hordes are invading, it's not Palestine. It's here. It could be Australia. It could be Europe. It could be South Africa. It's anywhere that the children of Israel, the real children of Israel, had traveled away from and settled in these new lands. And we record those travels. We've already done it from history and archaeology. That's the core of Christian identity. Satan was locked in a pit for 1,000 years in Europe. And that prophecy definitely correlates with this one. Satan was locked in that pit when the Jews had no rights of citizenship and no ability to swindle Christians in Europe without permission of a king, and had to turn most of their earnings over to the kings. They were property of the kings. Of course, they cheated the kings too, because they're Jews. They weren't citizens. They couldn't hold government offices. They couldn't own Christian slaves. They were severely restricted. They were basically locked in a pit for 1,000 years. They couldn't live in Christian neighborhoods. They had to live in special ghettos, which is where the word ghetto comes from.
What does that word have connotations of, like, Jew suburb or something?
Yeah, the ghetto was actually the area outside of a city where the Jew is forced to live.
The sewer. And then as soon as they come out of the sewer, they're bringing Magog and Gog against us. They're bringing the flood of the serpent as soon as they get out.
Well, right. I mean, the philosophical ideas of the Enlightenment were heavily influenced by Jews, and the idea of liberty, fraternity, and equality that came out of the Masonic lodges of the 18th century that were all infiltrated by Jews.
The brotherhood of man idea that all so-called men are brothers.
Yeah. The Jews had, I talked about this at length in my Jews in Medieval Europe series. The Jews had infested white European academia with the Kabbalah and these philosophical ideas of equality and brotherhood and basically precepts from the Talmud. And that's when the Dominican monks wanted to burn the Talmuds. And Pope Leo X, who was the Dei Medici, wouldn't let him do it. And then that sparked the Reformation, and the Jews got in bed with Martin Luther and Calvin and all the reformers. By the time Martin Luther realized their treachery, it was too late, and his own church never believed him.
If you believe in Luther today, well, not believe in Luther, but if you think he had something good to say today, they excommunicate you from the Lutheran Church.
If you brought a copy of the Jews and Their Lies to a Lutheran church, you'd be thrown out.
And if you told them the things that that Luther basically said, the Jews are poisoning me, they would laugh at you just like they'd laugh at Luther.
Well, there's a little more to talk about here in Ezekiel 38. That the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, that is kind of a questionable translation. And a New American Standard Bible, which is newer and usually, not always, usually in the Old Testament, it's more accurate than the King James. It is. And here in Ezekiel 38:2, it says, "Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." But in the Septuagint, and I could pretty much vouch for Brenton's translation here because I can read the Greek. Brenton wrote, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog and the land of Magog, Rosh, the prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him." So we have Gog, and Gog is from the land of Magog, and Rosh is the prince of Meshech and Tubal. And I'm not, it's difficult, the Hebrew is difficult to understand, and that's what his difference is in the translation. And it seems to me to be kind of coincidental that Meshech and Tubal can be identified with Eastern Europe, with regions in Eastern Europe, and what we know today is Russia. And this says that the prince of Rosh, or that Rosh is the prince of Meshech and Tubal, and the Rus were a Germanic tribe that came along probably 1,000-1,200 years after Ezekiel wrote, at least, and happened to rule over those places. So that's, it's intriguing. It might be an error in translation. It's difficult to discern. The Hebrew in that passage is quite ambiguous, but it is intriguing. And that's how I would explain it.
So what does that mean? That the Germans are leading the hordes? Can't mean that, so...
Well, we know that Russia isn't really Russia, isn't really Germanic anymore, not to a great extent. So I think it's just another hint at the identity of the rest of these people. That's all. But no, I think that the Russian Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews that have already taken ownership of all the West, it's just another passage that sort of hints at where they've come from. Because it's not the Russians themselves that are in charge of Russia, just like Americans aren't in charge of America. Just like Americans have no control of their policy.
Yeah, that's why we call it Zog.
Well, right. Well, Russia has a Zog too. And every nation in the West has a Zog, right? I mean, the Russians have had a Zog since 1905, probably. I don't know when the Kerensky government was installed. Maybe a little later than that. Maybe 1912 or something. When the Tsar actually abdicated. I'm going to look that up. I think it was 1912. I could be a year off there. Maybe 1914. Wow, later than I thought? No way.
1919.
No, because the Bolshevik Revolution was sooner than that.
Then what is it?
1917. That's later than I thought.
Okay.
I thought it was a couple of years. It wasn't even. It's only a couple of months. Damn. That's funny. I think there was a step between at before that, though. I really do. But I don't really remember the details. It's not my area of study, even though I've done a lot of work on the period. The revolution of 1905, that's what I was really thinking about.
Yeah, I think we might have rushed through Ezekiel 38 too quickly, Bill, so I apologize for that.
Well, I'm trying to atone for that. They shall ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land. The NAS has, you will be like a cloud covering the land. I don't agree with Comparé where he insisted that they would come under the cover of a cloud, meaning that they would come secretly. I don't agree with that. I can see where he was going with that or why he believed that, because all these immigrants come here and with the ideals, American ideals. They don't think it. But we think they share American ideals and they come in the name of peace and they want to be fellow citizens. We know, or we should know, that that's all bullshit. But Comparé tried to make it sound like they were coming in secretly in the open in that manner. But that's not what it says. There'll be like a cloud to cover the land. Yeah, because there's great hordes of them. There's an endless stream of them.
I also think like a dark cloud, because they're all dark and swarthy.
Yeah. The land of unwalled villages. In Ezekiel's time, every significant city or town had walls, right? Had some sort of a separation from the outside and a modicum means of defense. Towns and cities without walls would be unheard of in his time. And usually cities didn't have walls only if they were disgraced and lost a war and their walls would be destroyed. The Spartans did that to Athens in the 5th century. So a whole land of unwalled villages or towns would be an amazing thing to people at Ezekiel's time. But today, none of our cities have walls, right? I mean, medieval Europe had most of the cities were walled, but not our modern cities have no walls. So, I mean, a land of unwalled villages just signifies a land with cities with no walls or towns with no walls. That would be fantastic in Ezekiel's time, but today we see it's the norm in all white nations.
Could it be metaphorical too? Like the people no longer know anything, so they've let down their guard because they don't believe in God anymore. So they're like basically inviting these people in almost. They're not protected by God anymore because they've sort of turned away from God. And here's our true wall. Here's our true fortress. That's a bit metaphorical, but I'm thinking that too.
Well, In verse 4, I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws. So there's no choice. We had no choice that they're coming here. We had no choice but to see this immigration. It should say, I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws. They're coming here to be destroyed. They're ultimately all going to be destroyed. And that might sound fantastic, but that's the promise of Scripture. And when you see 2,000 or 3,000 years of prophecy unfold and understood that it's all come true, well, then you know they're all going to be destroyed. And you build that confidence through study.
Yeah. And they think they'll escape, but they're not going to escape.
Right. So God's right not going to be mocked forever.
Yeah. And right now they're proud. They think they're going to devour us. But then the tide will turn and they'll be like, oh, no, we got to get away. And it'll be like, there's no escape. There's no escape.
Well, the creation wasn't made for the sake of niggers and sand niggers and chiggers and spiggers and every other kind of fucking igger. No. Glot monsters. No, the creation wasn't made for their sake. They're just devourers of everything. You'll have to excuse me for a moment.
All right, well, I might start reading the next chapter, Bill.
Yeah, I think we've spoken about everything that we need to speak about. Look at verse 19, for in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath I have spoken.
Fire come down from heaven.
Right. So Yahweh God is going to avenge the children of Israel, first out of jealousy, but also to sanctify himself. And I really believe that has to relate to the promises made to the patriarchs, made to Abraham. That are recorded, that God has to keep his promises, that he's going to prove to us that he keeps his promises, that he's true, even when we fail, that he is true. Okay, I'll be back in a moment.
Yeah, well, where he says, I spoken, that's referring to his prophecy and his promises. And in the NLT, it actually says promise instead of I spoken. So that's a reference to his words right there. That in his wrath has he spoken his word. All right, I'll read 39 unless anyone has something to say.
Yeah, what about verse 21?
Hold on, 21. Wait, you're on 39, 21?
Sorry, 38 and 1.
Oh, every man's sword shall be against his brother. That's the enemy. Like in the time of Gideon. And he walks around the camp and he says the sword of Gideon and the sword of Yahweh, and it frightens the enemy and they are all confused because it's in the dead of night and they start killing each other. I'm thinking that's kind of how this is. You know, all the enemy nations will sort of turn on each other and start destroying each other as we destroy them too.
You kind of see that now, don't you?
Yeah, they're turning on each other. That's all they can do. They can never be in a true league with each other. They're always going to devour each other because that's their nature. That's the way I see that. I don't know if everyone else thinks that's the same. Every man's sword against his brother, that's the enemy.
Look at what they're doing now.
I was sitting there wondering. Yeah, I was sitting there wondering because man, it was only referring to us.
Hold on, yeah, but the word there is Enosh. So every man's sword, it's not H120, which would be Adam. It's H376. So that's Enosh. That could be a man of any race because it's a male, basically. So every male's sword shall be against his brother. So that definitely could be the enemy.
It's actually Ish.
Thanks for that clarification.
It's actually Ish, but Ish is also a general word for man.
Oops.
Ish and Enosh are both general words for man. They have different connotations. But the word Enosh simply means a mortal man. It doesn't mean a man of another race. And the word Ish simply means a man, usually a man of some sort of station. But even that could describe a man of any race. Only the word Adam is a racially specific word for man. Adam being one of the descendants of Adam, period. And niggers and chinks and people of other races simply are not descendants of Adam. We're told who the descendants of Adam are. Starting in the definition of the word Adam, but then continuing in Genesis chapter 10. Where the specific nations of Adam are listed. And there were no freaking Zulus or Chinamen or...
At the very next verse, it says, and I will plead against him, so I'm guessing against Magog and Gog, with pestilence and with blood, and I will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon the people that are with him, overflowing rain and great hailstones, fire and brimstone. So that's the enemy being destroyed. And when it says, I shall plead against him, that actually means, I'm checking the dictionary, I think it means punish. So it's not like he's pleading with them to do good. He's like judging them against them, and he's judging them with pestilence and with blood. He's destroying them, and their swords are against each other. So even in the time of Hezekiah, the enemy came against Israel, and God confused the enemy and made them all destroy each other.
Well, you know what? I've had a lot of firsthand experience of walking right through crowds of niggers and spics that were killing each other. And I'd be unscathed because I ain't one of them. And they do. They kill each other. In prison, the niggers from Detroit are always stabbing and beating up the niggers from Cleveland and the niggers from D.C. And the niggers from D.C. are killing fucking niggers from New York and Toledo. That they're very territorial. That they're always killing each other. They do it today. Just read the news. How many niggers are shot in Chicago or Philadelphia or every week? And who's shooting them? Other niggers are shooting them. They're shooting each other. It's constantly going on. And when it comes down to it, if you could just block all the highways coming out of Atlanta and cut off their food supply, they'd all kill each other in a couple of weeks. It'd be over. That's what they do. They kill each other. They have no care. They would kill white people if white people were there, but they have no care for life. That they just want to eat everything they can today. They don't care about tomorrow, and they'll kill each other to eat today. So that's what niggers do. That's also what Mexicans do. I've seen it. I've seen rival Mexican gangs, the Mexicans from Mexico and the Mexicans from California and Mexicans from Texas in federal prison, they all hate each other and they fight with each other. They never fought with me. I just walk right through their fights. They fight with each other. So I see that as an indication of the future and have actually seen that. Firsthand, that they do have a propensity to do that. That they, before they kill the white girl, they'll kill each other over who's going to get to rape her first. So, yeah, that passage makes a lot of sense to me. I'm sorry for the digression.
Yeah, they're all feeding on God's holy mountain, us, and they're fighting over the scraps now. That's what that'll do. All right, should I read chapter 39?
Yeah, let me just say this, though. There's something in the Bible called parallelism, and it's striking in Ezekiel. In earlier in Ezekiel, we had a lamentation for the prince of Tyre and a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and they were actually both for the same individual. They weren't for two different individuals. In Ezekiel, there are actually, I should have said King of Tyrus, because that's how it's translated in Ezekiel. Yet you have a lamentation for the King of Tyrus or Tyre in Ezekiel 28. And the Prince of Tyre in that same chapter. And my point is that both of them are just the same prophecies, but described in two different ways, right? It's Prince of Tyre in 28:2, and it's King of Tyre in 28:12. So they're both basically saying the same thing in two different ways. And that's called a Hebrew parallelism. And sometimes parallelisms are in two consecutive phrases or two consecutive verses, but sometimes they're in two consecutive chapters where the same phenomenon is described twice so that different aspects of it can be described each time to give you a fuller understanding of what's being described. It's like if I made a big description about how an engine works, and then I said, in other words, and made another description in different language of how the engine works, so that you understand better how it works, because you got two descriptions using slightly different language. And that's what's going on in Ezekiel, and it does occur in other places in Scripture. It's just usually not two entire passages or chapters right next to each other. So in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, what you have is a parallelism. Ezekiel chapter 39 is going to describe the same things that were prophesied in Ezekiel chapter 38, just from a slightly different perspective with slightly different allegories. That's it. But it's the same thing.
Well, in Genesis 10, there's like one line, and the earth was divided. And then you go to Genesis 11, and it takes that one line and it expands it. People say, well, was the earth divided twice? No, it wasn't divided twice. It's just that in verse 10, it just mentions it. And then in chapter 11, it describes the whole event in detail. So that's right. That's the best proof of a parallelism, I think, that I can think of.
And now you write my commentary for me, but no, I'm going to start. I'm gonna mention that this Friday with Genesis chapter 5, how it evokes language from Genesis chapter 1. And Genesis chapter 11 evokes that passage in Genesis chapter 10. Right. It's a parallelism, but it's also a recapitulation of sorts. And it's actually describing something that's already been described, but in different language, from a different perspective, perhaps more completely. So here we have Ezekiel chapter 39 is another prophecy of the same thing we heard in 38.
And I'll read it now.
From a different perspective. Different perspective, slightly different language.
Ezekiel 39. Therefore, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up from the north parts, and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. And I will smite thy bow out of thy hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beast of the field to be devoured. Thou shalt fall upon the open field, for I have spoken it, saith Yahweh God. I will send a fire on Magog and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them pollute my holy name any more, and the heathen shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. Behold, it is come, and it is done, saith Yahweh God. This is the day whereof I have spoken, and they that dwell in the cities of Israel shall go forth, and shall set on fire and burn the weapons, both the shields and the bucklers and the bows and the arrows and the hand staves and the spears, and they shall burn them with fire 7 years, so that they shall take no wood out of the field, neither cut down any of the forest, for they shall burn their weapons with fire, and they shall spoil those that spoil them, and rob those that robbed them, saith Yahweh God. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto Gog a place there of the graves in Israel, the valley of the passengers on the east of the sea, and it shall stop the noses of the passengers, and there shall they bury Gog and all his multitude, and they shall call it the valley of Hamon Gog. And 7 months shall the house of Israel be burying them, that they may cleanse the land. These people that dwell carelessly in the isles, that should be coast, because the rest of the army of Gog and Magog is on the coast.
I'm sorry, I had my mic muted and I didn't know when I was talking. I was running my mouth.
I should have. Wasn't sure.
Well. Anyway, a lot of people think that this language insists it's a military invasion. I can't rule out a military invasion. You can't rule it out. You can't. Prophecy isn't so that you could see the future. It's so that you could look back and see that God is true. So I can't rule out a military invasion or actual military actions on in Europe or here or anywhere, right? But this doesn't necessitate a military invasion. This has already come to pass. The other races have already flooded into all of our lands. They've already enriched themselves with our bounty. And if you don't believe that, come on down to spring break in Panama City Beach. It's starting up just now. And you'll see all these fucking 19-year-old niggers that never worked a day in their life. And they're driving $50,000, $70,000 vehicles. They got gold chains on. They got white girls. And it's just fucking incredible. The wealth that they have obtained from somewhere, at whose expense? Because they've never worked a day in their fucking lives, never. They've never earned through sweat the things that they possess. So they've already looted and pillaged us. They're looting and pillaging us now. It's the same thing with the Arabs and the Chinese, but they do it differently. And they may not show off the bling like the niggers do, but they still do it. They come over here, they get no taxes for 5 years. They get huge business loans to buy businesses. And whites never have those opportunities. And they make themselves millionaires inside of a few years. And whites never have those opportunities. Because whites have privilege. The Chinese have been, every Chinatown is basically a haven for crime rings. Every single one. They do all kinds of credit card fraud, business fraud. They do all kinds of other fraud. And they get away with it because they're an alien culture that's allowed to operate within our cities.
Yeah, sometimes I think the Chinks are better thieves than Jews.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't bother to learn your language so they can tell you about it.
In Clark's commentary, it's referring to those who dwell carelessly in the isles. It says that they're the auxiliary troops that came to from the borders. So it's like part of the same army, but they're just dwelling carelessly on the coast.
I don't agree with that. Which verse is that, Joe?
So at verse 6, it says, I will send a fire on Magog and among those that dwell carelessly in the isles, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Well, who are these people that are dwelling carelessly in the isles? And that word isles could also mean coast, as far as I understand.
Yeah, yes, isles also means coastlands. It always also means coastlands. It's never necessarily an island as we see an island today. And it, in all of our coasts, we have all these aliens that are dwelling carelessly. they're inhabiting all of our cities, and even most of the cities in the United States. It's not only Australia, Joe. Most of the major population centers in the United States are on waterways. New York, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, the Mississippi River Valley, and the Great Lakes. Most of our major population centers, and now they're all aliens. Baltimore, they're all aliens. They're all filled with spicks and niggers and chinks. And they're dwelling carelessly because that there are basically no more white men that'll stand up to them, and they can do what they want. And they're running things now. They're running our cities now. So yeah, they're dwelling carelessly in on all our coastlands and all the isles. Look at London.
There's not a port city in the United States that's not overrun.
Right, even St. Louis.
Yeah. We go to Houston, Texas. Wow.
So even though we live in the modern world, our cities are still, our nations are still structured around commerce by sea. And all those port cities are overrun. Maybe there's an exception in Baja, but Maine. Maybe. I doubt it now, though. That's probably loaded with niggers, too. I'm just
in America, like rural, even in Australia, too, rural areas are mostly white people. I was just thinking. Whereas the cities and that along the coast are like the hordes.
Right. In America, all the rural areas are mostly white people. With the exception maybe of South Louisiana and Mississippi and South Alabama. Because there's so many niggers. And also Eastern North Carolina and most of Eastern South Carolina.
Pretty much anywhere in the South that is close to the Mississippi River. In rural areas, you're going to find a lot of niggers.
Yeah. Well, that's because in the South, yeah, you know, in the North, when the niggers came North, they didn't come North in large numbers until the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s. And they concentrated them in the cities. In the South, that there was always this phenomenon of country niggers. And it amazed me to see how many niggers lived in rural areas when I first came through the South in 2012, the Deep South in 2012. I couldn't believe how many niggers lived out in the woods. But that phenomenon is a relic of the plantation days. It really is.
That's what we grew up calling the bottoms.
Yeah, country niggers.
Yeah, the just, you know, I was raised in the Ozarks, but we called the bottoms, you know, the flatland, like the Delta, the Arkansas Delta, Mississippi Delta, and all that, and the rural towns out there, and they're just, it's just nothing but niggers. But they're, you know, they'll be a town of 100 people, you know, or 500 people, and it's all niggers.
Yeah, you got a few here in North Florida, but not many. Nothing like Mississippi.
Are there any different from the niggers that are like in the cities?
Yeah, because they mostly know their place, right? Well, the niggers that are in the cities are all thugs now.
Are they at all self-sufficient?
Yeah, you know, I don't think they're self-sufficient, but they're a lot closer to it than the city niggers.
They'll actually, some of them, the ones that I've seen, and I wasn't raised around them, but I've seen where they're at, and I've seen a few of them. It seems like they will actually work, you know, enough to keep from starving to death.
Yeah, they'll actually hunt, too, and fish sometimes.
Yeah, they love to fish, you know, they'll go after the channel cats, mud cats. It's what my grandpa always, because he was raised in the bottoms, he was a row crop farmer, And he just, you know, he would refer to them as good old niggers. He'd say, you know, hey, he's a pretty good old nigger, but he's still a nigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to deal with a lot of Deep South niggers just for my job. A lot of them are truck drivers down there. And they're a pain in the fucking ass to work with, but they do the job, you know.
Even Melissa grew up calling them country niggers in Tennessee.
Yep. My grandpa would always say, you know, he's a pretty good nigger if he's just working by himself or if he's out there with the white men working. But if you get him around two or three other niggers, he goes right back to being a nigger.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. No, I don't care. I've seen this myself firsthand on many occasions. And I don't care if it's a Harvard, if the nigger is a Harvard educated lawyer. You get him around a bunch of city niggers and he's just going to be a nigger.
Yeah, they're the Harvard educated ones, probably worse than just a country nigger.
Yeah, right.
Because they know how to exploit the system.
Yeah, well,
the other ones are too dumb.
The country niggers still know that if they get too carried away, that there's a white man probably in a town over, you know.
Yeah. Sort of keeps them in check a little bit. The country niggas are more likely to do what they need to do to get by the white man and get along. But the thug niggers, that they're a different breed. Eventually, they're all going to be thugs.
Yeah, I've seen it's something that I seen whenever I was driving and delivering tanks down into northeast Arkansas. And over into Tennessee a little bit, sometimes into Mississippi. But in the rural areas like that, even in the nigger-dominated towns, a white man can walk in, be walking up to the door. Again, country niggers, not the city ones. But and they'll open the door for you, and they'll call you, yes, sir.
Yeah.
You know, how you doing, sir? Oh, yes, sir. No, sir. You know. All that, and they still have that. They're still humbled in a way, you know, somewhat.
Yeah, I understand. I see them all the time. I don't like them, but I see them. I don't like them because they're the niggas that are more likely to blend in with whites and get along with whites and have whites date them or befriend them. And
well, Bill, did you see that video I put on the Rocket Chat? It was some country nigger out of. Freaking, he was in Dothan, Alabama, and he had like put on like all this whole Confederate outfit and the overalls and everything. Every single video of his was about basically preying on white women, saying, "Oh, I would love to date a white woman." And he takes videos and pictures with them and uploads it and gets a bunch of views. Probably some Jew probably handled his page. I mean,
Dothan, Alabama. I'm planning on being there Saturday.
Godspeed. I mean, isn't it super black out there?
No, it's not. It's about 50-50, maybe 60-40. 60-40 in favor of whites, actually.
50-50 isn't that black?
Well, not in the South.
Part of Dalton, Alabama you go to, it's mostly black. It all depends on what part of Dalton, Alabama you go to.
Right. Well, we're going to the white part on Saturday. We're going to meet some friends at a brewery there. Where we're going, it's all white.
Yeah, when I move freight out of Dothan, I don't think I ever get white truck drivers. They're always fucking niggers.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I don't know how far we got on Ezekiel 39, but we're kind of off course, and I don't think we're done talking about this, Joe.
Yeah, we don't want to stop halfway, sure.
Okay.
So I think I was out verse 12.
Well, once again, here we have Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and... In the Septuagint, in Brenton's translation, and in Greek, it's Ross, Prince of Meshech and Tubal. And in the New American Standard Bible, it's Prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. Meaning that Gog is ruling over Ross, Meshech, and Tubal. Meaning that Gog is really the one bringing the hordes here. And that's the way it is. That seems to agree more with Revelation chapter 20. But what you have is you have three different people trying to read the Hebrew of Ezekiel 39:1, the King James translators, the men of in 300 BC or whatever it was that translated the Septuagint into Greek, and the New American Standard Bible translators, and they read it three different ways because that's how ambiguous the Hebrew is. It's difficult to understand. That's probably by design, but if we read them all, we understand who it's talking about. Once we see the revelation, we're sure of who it's talking about. So it takes study. Nobody's going to understand these prophecies without years of study and comparing the different similar prophecies and sources and things like that. That's a necessity. That's the way it's always going to be. So Yahweh God's going to smite the weapons in the hands of Gog and destroy them on the mountains of Israel. Now, whether he's going to do that by some supernatural means or whether he's going to do it through his people, because there are many prophecies, Revelation chapter 18 in the fall of Babylon, Revelation chapter 19 and the wedding supper of the Lamb, Micah chapter 4, Obadiah, all inform us that he's going to do this through his people. It could very well be a combination of both, right? And it most likely is. And I don't like to speculate, so I would leave it at that. I will send a fire on Magog. That fire could be his people. Obadiah, the book of Obadiah, speaking about the last days, says that I will make the house of Joseph will be a flame. So what we see that fire could very well be his people. In verse 7, the nation shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. The nations, not the heathen. It could very well be speaking of the nations of the children of Israel. And I believe that's what it's saying here, where it says, I will make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, which also tells me that that fire is going to be his people. It's not going to be some supernatural fire that comes out of the sky. Okay, we'll leave it at that. It might sound incredible to us now that enough of what's left of white Christians can possibly fucking wake up to do this, but that's what the text says, and that's what we should believe. But I wouldn't speculate and elaborate on it any more than the text does.
But when God makes their hooves brass and their horns iron and stuff like that, that says to me that when the Spirit of God comes on these people, it's sort of supernatural because they've got some sort of new power or new insight that allows them to destroy the enemy.
That's true. And you're alluding to a similar prophecy in Micah chapter 4. That's true. We don't know how it's going to happen, but we should just know that it's going to happen, that we have hope, even though it looks like we should be in despair, that we have hope and we should hold our heads up because we're going to prevail over all these niggers and spicks and chinks and all these other shitbags that have taken over our nation with the help of the Jew. In the end, we're going to win. If it's us personally or not, we know that God is going to win, and because God wins, that his people will prevail. The world's not going to be turned over to Jews and niggers.
No way.
This burning of the weapons is, that sounds a little weird, right? Because most weapons say they're steel and don't burn, right? And I'll leave that at that. 7 months to bury the bodies. Did you get
that's
that, John?
I'm about to read that. I think I'm on verse 13, but I'm going to start at 12. In 7 months shall the house of Israel be burying them, that they may cleanse the land. Yeah, all the people of the land shall bury them, and it shall be to them a renown the day that I shall be glorified, saith Yahweh God. And they shall sever out men of continual employment, passing through the land to bury with the passengers those that remain on the face of the earth, to cleanse it. After the end of 7 months shall they search, and the passengers that pass through the land, when that any seeth a man's bone, then shall he set up a sign by it, till the buriers have buried it in the valley of Hemengog. And also the name of the city shall be Hemenah. Thus shall they cleanse the land. And thou, son of man, thus saith Yahweh God, speak unto the every feathered fowl and to every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come, gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you, even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that ye may eat flesh and drink blood. Ye shall eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, and of goats, of bullocks, all of them, fatlings of Bashan. And ye shall eat fat till ye be full, and drink blood till ye be drunken, of my sacrifice which I have sacrificed for you. Thus ye shall be filled at my table with horses and chariots, with mighty men and with all men of war, saith Yahweh God. And I will set my glory among the heathen, and all the heathen shall see my judgment. All the nations shall see my judgment that I have executed, and my hand that I have laid upon them. So the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their God from that day and forth. And the nations shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them, and gave them into the hand of their enemies, so fell they all by the sword. Therefore, according to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them, and hid my face from them. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, now I will bring again the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my holy name. After that they have borne their shame, and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me, when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid. When I have brought them again from the people, and gathered them from their enemies' lands, and am sanctified in them in the sight of many nations, then shall they know that I am Yahweh their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the heathen, but I gathered them unto their own land, and have left none of them any more there. Neither will I hide my face from them any more from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith Yahweh God. Are you muted, Bill?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Technically, in the eyes of God, we're still in captivity. We are the children of the Israelites that went into captivity in 2700 BC. From 2700 BC to 2500 BC or 2580 BC. That's us. And that can be ascertained from ancient history and inscriptions. And once that realization is made, and a lot of our people had left the body politic of the Israelites even before that, all the way back to 1400 BC, 1500 BC. So once that's ascertained, and it can be, then the whole Bible makes sense, and none of it has a damn thing to do with Jews. And we've technically been in captivity since the ancient nation of Israel was destroyed. And that happened by the northern 10 tribes by 720 BC, when Samaria was destroyed, 721 BC, and it hasn't been a nation since then. It was once a very significant nation that ruled over much of the world, much of the known world at that time. So we are technically still in that captivity. That word heathen, and I want to clarify that, there's three words in the King James Version of the Bible that in the Old Testament, they're all translated from the same word, and the word is goy. And goy, or goyim, goyim in the plural, goyim literally means nations, period. That's all it means. In the singular, it means nation. In the plural, it means nations. But the King James sometimes translated as nations, and sometimes translated as Gentiles, and sometimes translated as heathen. And that's very dishonest, because when they pick and choose how they're going to do that, then they're not really making a translation. They're really making a commentary, and the commentary is wrong. it's not right. In the Greek New Testament, they did the same thing with the word ethnos. Sometimes they translate it as nation, sometimes they translate it as heathen, and sometimes they translate it as Gentile, but it means nation. It doesn't mean heathen or Gentile, and it certainly doesn't mean non-Jew. And that is a huge lie perpetrated by the Jews. There are bigger lies in the Holocaust that have been perpetrated by the Jews. One of them is to make people believe that Jesus was actually a Jew, and the other one is to twist this word goy it into meaning non-Jew, but that's never been what it means. Rebecca was told by God that there were two goy in thy womb. So whether you're Jacob or Esau, you're a goy, and none of you are Jews. So that's what he said. And if you use the Jewish definition of the word goy and try to apply it to that passage, it comes out ridiculous. It really does. The word goy means nation, period. And here, it's basically speaking of the nations of Israel, even though sometimes it's referring to these other Adamic nations that are going to be destroyed. So, captivity among the heathen is captivity among the nations. And that's a reference to the Assyrians and the Persians and the Medes and the other people that the ancient children of Israel were taken into captivity and planted among, settled among. I don't know if I have anything else to say about this passage that I haven't said. But the scripture is pretty clear. I will bring the captivity of Jacob. This isn't referring to Jews. And in fact, in the context of Ezekiel himself, it can't be referring to Jews. It's everything that's spoken in Judeo-Christian churches is just a deception. Because not anybody could be of the captivity of Jacob because they claim they want it. Oop, Patras skipped out pretty quick, but that's all right. I'll leave my commentary at that. I mean, I don't know. Y'all might have other things you think need to be discussed.
Well, verse 18, it says, all of them fatlings of Bashan. Was Bashan an Edomite city? I can't remember what the Edomite city was.
No, Bashan was given to the half-tribe of Manasseh.
Yeah, I thought I was mistaken.
Bashan is where Og of Bashan was conquered by the Israelites. And that the Amorites were driven out of there by the Israelites. And it was given to the half-tribe of Manasseh.
Is there a prophecy in Isaiah or something that says he who comes out of and trample out of a city and he tramples the grapes or something? Look, it is he who coming from Bozron. Is that the Edomite city?
Oh, Bozron is that's Edom, right? That's Edom, but not Bashan.
Yeah.
Bashan was in the it wasn't really in the land of Canaan. It was an Amorite city, even though the Amorites are Canaanites. It was east of the Jordan and north of Jerusalem or even north of Jericho. East of the Jordan, so it fell to the half-tribe of Manasseh. It was north of Moab. The Ammonites dwelt there. But the Amorites took it from the Ammonites. The Ammonites coming from Lot and the brother of the Moab was Ammon, and the Amorites being a tribe of the Canaanites. But Og of Bashan was clearly one of the Rephaim. One of the Nephilim.
Yeah, well, the only other verse that I still have to think about is that where they bury the man's bone. We've already discussed that on the forum. The passenger, because I'm just reading that over and over, the passengers that pass through the land when any seeth a man's bone. This might not necessarily be the final battle. This might be precipitating, you know, just before it or something, because they're cleaning the land. So that what might be why there's a man's bone that they have to bury?
Well, that's something else I wanted to talk about, was that 7 months to cleanse the land. That's technically, if we look at a day being a year in prophecy, as it is almost everywhere else in Ezekiel, that's 210 years. 7 prophetic months would be 7 times 30 years, or 210 years. And when you think about it, that's a lot more realistic.
Yeah. I mean, after the final battle, we're going to have all the time. And then we'll forget about them forever. But yeah, the fact that it's like you were saying before, like Gog and Magog is actually like places in Russia, and it indicates they've become mixed over time. But at Ezekiel's time, these nations would have been white nations, wouldn't they?
Yes.
So he's seeing this vision and he's seeing them cleanse the land. And at that time, the enemies, you know, out here it says, the nation shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity because they trespassed against me. Therefore, I hid my face from them and gave them into the hands of the enemies. Well, those enemies at that time would have been white nations like Assyria and Egypt. So I'm not sure if it's so, you know, shocking to have a man's bone here. No, H120 at verse 15, we've got a man's bone that's been buried. Well, the enemies of Israel at that time in Ezekiel's vision, even though now they're mixed, at that time they weren't mixed.
No, this time they weren't mixed. And even though they've become mixed through these names, we can still see that these are the bastard descendants that are invading our lands today are from these regions, from these people. But today they're mostly bastards.
I would like to think that there's not going to be any remnant from the Jews, you know, in the kingdom. Like, you don't want to come across a Jew bone and be like, oh, I just defiled myself. I just accidentally touched a Jew bone. Even though I don't know what the kingdom's going to be, I would think that you don't want any remnant of these people, any memory.
I don't know how you're going to forget all the kikes and abos and other disgusting creatures you've seen all your life. I mean, they won't have memorials.
Yeah, no way. But some people will be in everlasting contempt because of what they did for the other races.
Oh, absolutely, and against their own. Okay. I'm going to end the recording, Joe.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
All night.